When you think of joy, what do you think of? Do you think immediately of laughter, happiness, Christmas maybe, a lightness of the soul, a radiance maybe? Maybe life is such that you can't even imagine or think of what joy looks like. For you, there is little laughter, little happiness. Instead of a lightness of the soul, there's a heaviness of the heart. And yet, recognizing that may be the case, the Bible still commands us to be joyful always. So what does the Bible mean when it says, be joyful? Because it can't be continual laughter and happiness. It can't mean that, because the perfect man, Jesus, wept and was sad and was not continually laughing and happy, and yet he must have been joyful always. So how are we to be joyful at all times? How can I be joyful even as I face the treadmill of life? When I'm in the pit, when I'm depressed, when I'm facing frustration and disappointment and upset and grief? Well, that's what we're going to see this morning as Jesus continues to prepare his disciples for his departure and a time of grief. And he does so by teaching them on joy, as it were. Now, Jesus has already made it clear that he is leaving. That's what we've been seeing as we've been studying these chapters of John before Christmas. He's been instructing his men on some of the long-range implications of his imminent departure. So he's been speaking of a spiritual intimacy that they will experience with him, the true vine. It will result in fruitfulness and prayer and joy and loving obedience. But he's also told them that they'll face opposition and persecution and even torture and death for following him. But he's also told them about his provision of another counselor, the Holy Spirit, who is given to help them and strengthen them. And he's detailed the Spirit's ministry and work. And now in the passage before us this morning, he turns again to the work of the cross and his resurrection. But not in terms of salvation history or from his perspective of suffering and torment and rejection. But he does so now from the point of view of his disciples, who will face profound grief and confusion during the next 3 days. And he seeks to meet their need as he talks about the joy that will shortly be theirs. So firstly then, joy because of the cross and the resurrection, verses 17 to 22. See, the question, verse 18, that the disciples are asking themselves as they wander the streets of Jerusalem is, what does Jesus mean when he says a little while? He said that back in verse 16. And they've begun to ponder it. They've begun to think about what he actually means. And you can understand their confusion. They know Jesus is leaving. But they've not sorted out the various returns that he would make, that he's been speaking of. Be it the return at the resurrection, the return of the Holy Spirit, the return at the final days. And so they're confused. Now, to us standing this side of the cross and resurrection, we can see that Jesus is speaking of his death and post-resurrection appearances prior to his ascension. But Jesus does not explicitly answer the disciples' question. Instead, he discerns that their deepest concern is his departure, not the meaning of a phrase. They're upset and they're confused. But above all, they're still ill-prepared for the acute grief that will shortly be theirs. So he begins to prepare them. Have a look, verse 20. I tell you the truth. You will weep and mourn while the world rejoices. You will grieve, but your grief will turn to joy. See, Jesus promises, although you will grieve, that grief will turn to joy. Just as a woman, verse 21, giving birth has pain when her time has come, But when the baby is born, she forgets the anguish because of the joy. She must do, otherwise no one would ever have two. And so says Jesus, just like the woman, it is with you, verse 22. Now is your time of grief, but I'll see you again and you will rejoice and no one will take away your joy. You see, but what the disciples don't understand is that it is the cross and the resurrection that will bring their joy, a lasting joy. See, just like the woman who gives birth, the very thing that causes her immense pain also brings her immense joy. And the very thing that generates the disciples' grief, the cross, will ultimately prompt their joy as he is risen and as they see him. And as he stands before them and they see him again after the cross, they'll come to understand that all he has said is true. That he is God, that he is the way, the truth, and the life, that he has prepared a room for them in his Father's house, that they can experience lasting relationship with him who is the true vine. And all of this is possible because of the cross and the resurrection. And at that moment, their grief will turn to joy, and that joy will not be taken away. For their joy becomes rooted in what the cross has achieved eternally for them. And the same is true for us. It's the cross and the resurrection that brings us joy. See, even though we don't experience the same grief about the cross that the disciples did, we do share their joy as we understand who Jesus is and what the cross has achieved. That through it, Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. You see, our joy arises from, because of, what the cross and the resurrection achieves eternally for us. See, all too often, we think that our joy comes in what we do, in what we achieve, in what we have, in what we experience. But that's what the world says. That's where the world finds its joy. And so when we fail to achieve, and when all we have is taken from us, and when our expectations are not met, the kids are ill again, whatever it is, we're crushed. We despair. Because our joy was in those things. And they've been taken from us. And you only have to look at the world to see how true that is. How they put their joy in what they have, in what they experience, in what they can get. And when those things are taken, folks are crushed. It's no wonder, is it, that depression is on the up. See, true joy, true, lasting, sufficient joy arises not because of what we do or what is happening to us, but because of what Jesus has achieved for us on the cross. That's what turned the disciples' grief to joy in an instant. And that joy cannot be taken away from us because it's not rooted in what we do or what happens to us, but in what Christ has already achieved for us on the cross. And Jesus spells that out, what the cross achieves for us and the joy that brings us in the next few verses. You see, secondly, the joy of relationship, verses 23 to 28. The joy of relationship. And in these verses, Jesus begins to give the disciples a foretaste of what is to come because of the cross and the joy that brings. Just notice how many times he says, in that day. See verse 23, in that day. Verse 24, until now. Verse 25, a time is coming. Verse 26, in that day. Do you see how they're all looking ahead? Verse 28, I came from the Father and entered the world. Now I'm leaving the world and going back to the Father. He's looking ahead. And it's that verse 28, it's that final journey of going back to the Father that will bring about that day that he's speaking of. The journey of death and resurrection. And that journey will bring about joy, verse 24. And he's already said it will be good for the disciples, 16, verse 7. And why will it bring joy? And why will it be good? Because Jesus' death and resurrection enables them and us to have a direct, intimate, personal relationship with the Father. See, look how things will change in that day. See verse 23 again. In that day, you will no longer ask me anything. I tell you the truth, my Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. See verse 25. I will tell you plainly about my Father. Verse 27. The Father himself loves you because you have loved me and have believed that I came from God. The cross achieves for us a direct, personal, intimate relationship with the Father. What greater joy could there be? And all along, Jesus has been revealing the Father to us, isn't it? It's what John declared right at the beginning, chapter 1, verse 18. No one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known. And the cross brings us that joy because it enables us to have a direct personal relationship with the Father who Jesus has been made known. See, no Jew would have ever dared to call God Father. That would have been regarded as blasphemous. See, in the Old Testament, the Lord was utterly separate and distant from his people. It's not because he didn't love them or he didn't want a relationship with them. He did. After all, he set up the whole sacrificial system so that he, the utterly holy and righteous God, could dwell in the midst of his sinful and rebellious people. And in the heart of the temple was the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctuary where God alone dwelt. And this inner sanctuary was surrounded by a very thick curtain. And only the high priest could go into that inner sanctuary once a year. And when he went in, he had a rope tied around his foot in case he died in there so that they could pull him out, because no one else was allowed to enter, only the high priest. And the whole Old Testament system was a giant visual aid to God's people. That God is holy and you aren't, so you can't come near to God. You need a mediator. You need one who will stand between you and God, one who will intercede for you. You need a go-between. And what do the other Gospels recall the very moment Jesus died? The curtain at the heart of the temple was supernaturally torn from top to the bottom. The giant no-entry sign was ripped up in an instant. How? Because of what Jesus achieved on the cross. Because as Jesus died, he was dealing with the problem of sin. Jesus was taking the punishment for all the sins of all God's people for all time. See, Jesus, our great high priest, was making it possible to walk straight into the very throne room of heaven and meet with God the Father. The author of Hebrews puts it like this, chapter 10, verse 19. Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain, that is his body, and since we have a great high priest over the house of God, let us draw near to God the Father with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience, and having our bodies washed with pure water. Do you see the implication? This side of Easter, we no longer need a go-between. Not even Jesus. We have direct access to the very throne room of God. We have direct access to the Father. See, look again, verse 23. In that day you will no longer ask me, referring to Jesus, anything. I tell you the truth, my Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. Until now, you have not asked for anything in my name. Ask and you will receive, and your joy will be complete. In other words, up till now, Jesus says, I've been revealing the Father to you. I've been your intermediary, a go-between, between you and the Father. But on that day, after Easter Sunday, you will have direct access to the Father because of what I will achieve. Because of my name and all that represents, you will be able to ask the Father directly yourself for whatever in accordance with my name and his will. And Jesus makes it very clear, verse 26. It's not that we ask in his name by going to him, and then he goes and asks the Father on our behalf. No, it's because of his priestly work, his death on the cross, represented by his name, we can ask the Father directly in his name. You see, the Father loves us, verse 27, because we have loved Jesus. And don't mishear that. The Father has always loved us. It's not suddenly going to change just because of Easter. He's always loved us. John 3, verse 16 makes that clear. For God so loved the world that he sent his one and only Son. But now, those who believe can be accepted and enter the very throne room of God. They can enjoy an intimate, personal relationship with the Father, with no more intermediaries, no more priests, no more saints, no more rosaries, no more doubt, but direct, permanent, intimate access to the Father who made us and sent his Son to die for us. And that is why the disciples' grief will turn to joy in verse 20 in an instant. Because that's a relationship that's worth having. And that's a relationship that's even better than having Jesus with us in the flesh. Direct access to the Father. Able to ask for whatever we want. See verse 23, 24 again, we see it there. In that day you will no longer ask me for anything. I tell you the truth, my Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. And to ask for whatever is not a whatever you desire. It can't be, because we can all think of prayers that do not glorify God. You know, for example, God, please make me more important than yourself. Or God, please wipe all people away who upset me. Or God, please stop Tottenham Hotspur winning anymore. Or God, please make pornography a godly thing to look at once a week. Or God, blind the Inland Revenue to all the times I've lied on my tax returns. No, when Jesus says, whatever you ask, the whatever is qualified by his name. And Jesus has spelt that out back in John 14, verse 13, where he says, I will do whatever you ask in my name so that the Son may bring glory to the Father. And thus the whatever is whatever will bring glory to the Father, whatever will show that he is supremely glorious, supremely wonderful, that will show how holy and awesome he is. And that is ultimately, therefore, in line with his will and purposes. And Jesus says, you pray like that, then your joy will be complete, verse 24. And our joy will be complete. Because as you pray like that, you are deepening your relationship with the Father as you spend time with him in prayer. But also as you become more like him, as you pray according to his will and purposes. And you begin to act according to his will and purposes. You see, in the chapter 4, chapter 15, and verses 9 to 11, Jesus has said, look, those who love me obey me. And obedience will bring joy. And you can see how those things are tied. For as you pray, as you pray according to God's will and purposes, you'll begin to live according to God's purposes. And of course, that will complete our joy. Because if I'm praying and living according to God's purposes and seeking his glory, we're living as God intended for us to live. So of course, it will be the most joyful way to live. I don't know about you, but I find that when I do a job and you have the right tools and you do it the right way, it becomes a joy. Just before Christmas, I started getting into having an open fire in our lounge. Not literally, but in a proper fireplace. And we had the chimney swept, and I went according to the purposes, and I built it up, and it looked good, and it, and then it kind of went out. And I confess to you that it took me nearly an hour to try and get this thing going, and eventually I think I got a few coals to burn and a little bit of heat. And I thought, not very successful, but I'll try again. And the next day I tried again, and a couple of days running, I still experienced this. So I went next door to see my neighbor, and my neighbor's an expert in fire building. And she showed me what she did, and I thought that looked good. So I went home, and I built this fire big, and lots of wood and bits and coal and paper. And again, it went, and nothing. So the next day she comes in, and she sees, she says, Mark, she says, you need a grate. You can't build a fire in the ash pan. So I ordered a grate, and you know what? Put the grate in, built the fire, and it kept going. And it was warm, and it was good. It was a little bit too toasty. I had to open the window. But I was joyful. But if you don't have the right tools and you don't do it the right way, then it becomes a frustrating and annoying. And the same is true with life, isn't it? See, if you live according to God's purposes and intentions, and you're praying according to God's purposes and intentions, and you're living it out, well, then of course your joy will be complete, because you're living as God intended. And such joy is possible even in the toughest of scenarios. Because even in the midst of trials and tribulations, if one is seeking to obey and pray in line with God's will, flowing from our direct personal relationship and intimacy with the Father, Jesus says, you'll be joyful. It's not laughter, but deep, satisfying joy. See, Jesus was the most joyful person to ever live, for he perfectly obeyed the Father. He prayed in line with the Father's will. He enjoyed the intimate personal relationship with him. Even through the darkest of trials, he could be joyful, because he knew the sheer delight and joy of relationship with the Father seen in obedience and prayer. That's why the disciples' grief turned to joy. And it was such joy that even when they faced persecution weeks and months later, what do they do, Acts 4? Praise God. Because they're obeying and acting in line with his will, and they're able to have joy even in the face of persecution. And it's why, as you read the biographies of saints who have suffered, they can speak of joy. If you read a book we recommended before Christmas, Evidence Not Seen, it tells the story of Darlene Diebler Rose and her horrific capture and torture in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. And she's physically unwell with numerous diseases. She's hit, she's beaten, she's left on her own, thinking she's going to die at any minute, or be tortured with having a tube put down her throat and water pumped into her stomach. And yet all the time through that, what does she speak of? Her joy. That of an intimate personal relationship with the Father, as she sought to obey, as she sought to pray in line with his will. Even in those trying circumstances, she had joy. And that's biblical joy. It's not based on what we do or on what is happening. It's based on what Jesus has achieved for us. It's that direct, intimate, personal relationship with the Father expressed through prayer and obedience. And if you want to assess if you have biblical joy, ask yourself this. Does obedience to Christ make us warm with joy? Does fruitful petitionary prayer to our loving God and Father complete our joy? Then we are approximating Jesus' expectation of what his followers would experience this side of the cross because of the cross. But if obedience is distasteful, and when grudgingly pursued, the source of more dissatisfaction than joy, or if prayer, however difficult, always fails to evoke joy in your heart, even though you discipline yourself to pray, then the alarm bell should be ringing, because it probably signals that your joy is bound with the world than it is with the Father and what Christ has achieved for us through the cross. And if that is you, then look again at the cross. Think upon the bigness of your sin, and marvel at the grace and forgiveness that has been given to you. And then speak with a friend ask and pray with you, do whatever you have to rekindle your joy. And if you do not know how to, then seek a wise friend or elder, but do not live as one who has no joy, as one who has bitterness in their heart, no matter how trying the circumstances or situation. For as believers, we do have real joy because of what the cross has achieved. And even in troubles, Jesus underlines that in these final few verses, 29 to 33, joy in trouble through peace. You see, it's possible, isn't it, to read these previous verses and think there is no longer trials or suffering for Christians to face, no troubles ahead. But Jesus makes it very clear, both for the disciples and for us, that this is far from the truth. See, the disciples think they get it. They think that the day has come, for they say, verse 29, now you're speaking clearly and without figures of speech, and they declare that Jesus is God. And yet the reality is they don't get it. It's only Maundy Thursday. Friday's not come. Sunday's not happened. Jesus has not died and risen. And Jesus has been explaining that after Easter Sunday, everything would be made clear. After Easter Sunday, they would receive joy. But they think they get it now. And Jesus says no, answering with gentle irony in verse 31. You believe at last, or literally, do you believe now? And the implication is no, you can't do. It's only Maundy Thursday. Everything, verse 25, will be made plain after my death and resurrection. In fact, things are still going to get worse, verse 32. Because when he gets arrested in just a few hours, they will all desert him. But their trouble does not end there. In fact, whilst they live in this world, they will have trouble because of their relationship with the Father. Just as they will have trouble, so will we. For Jesus has already promised that in chapter 15, the world hates us, the world will persecute us. And so often, just like the disciples, we don't get it. We think, we believe, surely God is on our side. And so there will be no more troubles or grief. And we look at our lives and we think of the sacrifices. We think of our service. And we think, why us, God? Why should we face trouble? And yet Jesus, again, in his love for them and us, prepares us for such a time so that our joy is not robbed. See verse 33, I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble. But take heart, I've overcome the world. See, we will have trouble, but we will have peace. And this peace will come because Jesus has warned us in advance. And so we know that Jesus is in control. He's warned us. And knowing he's in control brings peace. But Jesus also makes it clear, it's not that he just knows in advance there will be trouble. He's also overcome the world and the troubles it brings to those who are his. You see, the world thinks it's in control. The truth is, Jesus is. And in overcoming the world, it means that there is a time when that victory will be revealed and that overcoming will be complete. And knowing that brings peace to the believer. A deep inner peace that will keep us firm through the storms of life. Enabling us to obey and pray in line with the Father's will, and thus bringing us joy. We've gone full circle. The cross and resurrection bring us joy. It brings us relationship with the Father and peace in trouble. See, the Christian life is an emotional roller coaster of failures, of setbacks, of tough times, as well as the elations and the good times. But in all of those, we can have peace, for Jesus is in control. And knowing that surely brings us joy, because our joy is rooted in what Christ has achieved, not in the setbacks or the good times. And so as we close, let me ask you, do you have joy? Biblical, lasting, sufficient joy. That remains through trials and produces peace in trouble. And if you want true joy,
Look to the cross and root your joy in that and not the things of this world.